Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that down. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that down. Wait.
Yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
What it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
A sexy ass off my mind. Heartfelt hugs with some juicy kisses. On vacation, taking the flies, bitches. Bought a meal that same day that she did. Zaim said he seen her flexing with some new kids. I want her back, now I'm flying in the scene. She living the best life, I'm home daydreaming.
Yeah, that was Daydreaming from Pop the Brown Hornet. And what's the deal, man? This is King Eric representing Off the Cuff Radio, the livest show on Friday nights. Now we're working with the flexible hours. You can catch me on Saturday night with my boys Black Poet and Comet on Saturday night with Schoolboy Radio. And we got exclusive interview lined up for y'all tonight. I got my host T-Match with the facts in the building.
What it do, y'all? OTC up in the building. Wild Out Wednesday. What's going on? What's going on?
Yes, sir, man. Hard day's work is over with, and we usually don't really do Wednesdays, but we had to make this Wednesday suitable because we got a special guest on the line tonight, man.
Jip.
This guy here, man, one of the best spitters from the Wu affiliates. Probably heard the infamous classic, Black on Black Crime. And you know the cool part about it is he never stopped working. He kept pushing. He kept grinding. He never let the industry get the best of him. So here to tell his story, to tell his truth, and to let us know what he got going on for 2021 in his fourth quarter, Pop the Brown Hornet. You on the line, my brother.
Jip.
Bumble Fire.
What's going on? This is Pop the Brown Hornet from out of Stapleton, Staten Island. You know, yes, and true indeed, veteran, been doing it for over 25 years. So, yeah, I do date back, and I do have history in this here hip-hop music, this hip-hop industry.
Yes, sir.
Man, look, it's great to have you on, man. You know, representing, you know, with that stinger of rhyme slinging, man. It's always great to see, you know, legends of, you know, vintage dope just getting out there, man, with the most.
No, I appreciate you, brothers, you know, giving your platform to me so I can get acquainted with some of the already diehard fans and maybe grab another fan or two after the interview is through.
Definitely, man. You know, so, I mean, look, we're always, this is what we do on Off the Cuff, man. Shout out to King Eric, of course, you know, this being his baby in terms of what he, you know, had the, you know, brainchild to do with it and just all of us, you know, pitching in, man. I mean, this is, we always want to make sure that all of our legends are properly acknowledged in terms of their contributions and, most importantly, to tell their story of how they made those contributions. I guess it's all in order, you know, Pop. I mean, you know, I know it's like, I guess we just get to it. Tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, where you're from, how you got started, and, you know, everything.
All right. So you know, just to give a history on individuals who might not be abreast on who Pop the Brown Hornet is, I ran from out of Stapleton, Staten Island. One of the first, I've been doing it for eons. I was one of the individuals who used to make music in the mid '80s, and with R&S up in the house out in the Temple of Stapleton, and you know, we used to have the 4-track before it led to the 8-track, and we make songs and we throw it on a cassette and we throw it out into the streets, and it would be pumping in the Cunyons. So we had a lot of underground street hits before everybody was even really getting onto wax. So me dealing with R&S, and R&S is one of the forefathers of Staten Island. He's touched Shaheem, he's touched Wu-Tang, he's touched King Just, he's touched the UMCs, and numerous others, including myself. He's touched GP The Grain, which I was a part of that group as well. GP Wu signed to MCA Records. So, yeah, we started back in the 80s, and before everybody really started, we felt like we never really had a voice in the hip-hop arena. So, we had the traditional Force MDs, which you just played, the legends of Staten Island, and more or less, it gave it a tough act to follow, you know, with those brothers representing. So it was definitely an honor to be able to make a song with the Force MDs. Shout out to the Force MDs, definitely Daydreaming, classic, roller skate type of, you know, barbecue vibe type of song. Classic throwback. They don't even make them like that anymore. So, and with me being a staple and a foundation in the throwback, would you say, 80s, 90s era. That's why I was able to do a song with the Force MDs in 2021, because behind the scenes, those brothers understand my story. They know who I am, and they know I have the legwork, the track work. They know I've been involved with Shaheem, the Rugged Child, in his earlier stages coming up out of Stapleton, Staten Island. They know I've been a part of the history of the Wu-Tang era. So, yeah, I've been around for a very long time. And like you've mentioned, one of my claim to fame songs that the world may know me from, my vintage fans, Vintage Brown Hornet, would be Black on Black Crime, would definitely be one of the singles that, like I said, individuals may know me from back in the days.
Definitely, man.
Hey, you know what? You know the chop it up about that song for a minute. I gotta say this, and this, you know, bringing a little humor into the interview. That was one of those records that not only made you think, but also made you sad. Cause you know how it was when the MTV rotation, where you had none but party song. I put that in the same lane of Brenda's Got a Baby, cause then that, after the party songs, and that record would come on. And it make you all sad and all that, and it make you think at the same time. And that was one of those records that came to that vein. Like, you hear More Money, More Problems, and Hypnotize, and your record come on, and you like, damn, we back to reality.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny that you should say that, because I know that when people make music, and more or less nowadays, it's more prone to be that way. It's just about party, party, party. And when you do get a conscious song, it kind of, like you said, kind of like throws a little wrench into what was going on. But at the same time, it's those songs that really do stick out and they have longevity in your brain. I mean, for it to, during the time when I did that song, it wasn't really a popular thing to do. Everybody was glorifying what was going on in the streets. And I had to take the time out to say, you know, before we, you know, as much as we glorify, you know, we out there swinging crack and we making money and, you know, whatever, whatever. There's a flip side to that coin, you know. And it's unfortunate that back in the days I've seen kind of foreseen what was going to happen in today's day, where Black on Black, I mean, when we did it back in the days, of course, it was still ignorant and stupid, and it seemed like it was justifiable because there was a lot of money involved, to where now it's just like gang related, and it's just more, it just seems like a lot of things could be avoided. You know, it seems just like a lot of, it just seems more chaotic now than it seemed like, but back then it was over money and drugs. Not to say it's not now. It just seems more rampant to be gang-related.
So yeah,
black,
you know,
black on black.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know what you know, Pop, you make a great point about it, Pop, because when we look at it in terms of, like you said, you've been doing this over 25 years, we look at where going into the 90s, of course, you know, early 90s, where, of course, with NWA, you know, well, late 80s, early 90s, we kind of saw it going into more of the pronounced street level, where back in the day it seems like the stories that were being told on Wax weren't pretty. It was violent. It was, you know, explicit, but it was like there was a story being told behind it. It wasn't a glorification of it, where some tried to say, like, of course, C. Dolores Tucker, Reverend Calvin Butts, and all of them tried to say it was. It was just a story that was being told from the streets onto Wax, where you said you kind of saw it then as to where it was going to go to now. Do you feel like in terms of where some of the songs, the music is now, that it's kind of a more indulgent self-glorification of destruction in the black community?
Well, I think that once it went corporate, hip-hop that is, and they seen, you know, because this wasn't even supposed to last, but once they seen it took it by storm, it became corporate, and so
right
the individuals and the program directors, and really the program directors, you know. So once they program, once they decided to say, you know what, let's deal with the artist that's going to fill the jails. You know, let's deal with this artist that's going to glorify street activity, be it violence, be it drugs, be it sex. Let's put those artists into the forefront of hip hop. So it can, you know, because of the bottom is a reflection of what's at the top. So if we put these hip hoppers and glorify them and whatever they sprue out their mouth, be it Cash Rule Everything Around Me, be it, you know, Bling Bling, be it whatever, be it Pop These Pills, Sister Scissor, or whatever it is, Molly Percocet, all of these things that, you know, the program director set up for us to hear, it kind of weeded out it weeded out the Poor Righteous Teachers, the X-Clan, the you know, the Public Enemies, the KRSs, the intelligent hip hop, like he mentioned, when you heard the Biggie and this, that, and the third, but when you heard that Black on Black, it means you, and that's why I named myself Pop the Brown Hornet, because from day one when I came out, I always felt like hip hop was going to need a savior, you know, and Pop the Brown Hornet, I got the Brown Hornet from the Fat Albert cartoon, you know, and he was a black superhero, because when I was a child, I grew up with a complex. There wasn't black TV shows that came on. There wasn't black superheroes to look up to. So, you know, I grabbed onto something and I said, you know what, I'm going to embody the Brown Hornet. I'm going to be a messenger. And as much as I'm indulging all kinds of different hip hop, I always want to be in tune with giving a message, regardless if it's party or whatever it is, because I just feel like I have to touch someone. I have to be able to reach somebody and make a difference to them. And I think that, you know, once you, the objective in life is always to stand out, never to fit in. But a lot of people want to fit in just to be accepted, you know. But to stand out, it takes a strong individual to do so.
Exactly. That's real, that's what it needed, that balance.
Definitely. And when you look at it, Pop, you know, like, you know, King, you know, when we look at hip-hop now, man, it's just crazy because, like you said, and we just kind of take it back to a time where, you know, for what it was, you know, it just seemed to be a lot of diversity, you know, and back in the day, you could listen to all different types, and it was something for everybody. And now it's like, when you look at program directors, the lack, you know, back in the days, DJs really got to break records in terms of stuff that was dope. You know, now it's not like that anymore. They got a playlist. They got to go by radio stations to become corporate in terms of being bought up by a lot of people. It's just changed now. And especially the images that are being put out, especially the fashions and all that. What are your feelings, Pop, about the direction of where it is right now from the aesthetic?
Oh, well, I think that what happens is this. Like I said, we just talked about the 90s and the destruction of the men as far as the masculine male with drugs, violence, and sex, to where we bring it to the present day where they've broken us down using their commercial drugs, you know, from the drugs to the scissor to popping pills to ecstasy to, you know, just making us more sexual creatures. And the sexual creatures, whether it be man on man or woman on woman, now that that has been promoted, and once Obama had made, you know, same-sex marriages legal, everybody's come out the closet. And so I think they've infiltrated hip-hop, you know, the genre of hip-hop, because hip-hop isn't what it used to be, like you just said. They've broken it down. Hip-hop is more, back in the 90s and the, you know, the 2000s, and when you used to listen to the radio, they'd be like, where hip-hop and R&B lives. And they did that around the nation, where hip-hop and R&B lives. And that generation grew up, and they meshed hip-hop and R&B together. So now we got the Drakes and beyond. You know, everybody has to harmonize inside their music. So they watered down the true essence of a raw hip-hop album. like a DMX. You know what I mean? They said, you know what? Our kids are our college kids are into this music. It's too hardcore. Let's soften it up. And, you know, and they also softened up our masculinity, and they softened up our dress code. They have men wearing tutus, man purses, dyeing their hair, painting their nails. You got this boy acting like he's pregnant. You know, all of these are people that are already in the system. They're part of the program, and it's all to infiltrate us and to embody a whole different culture that has nothing to do with hip hop. But they don't have, as long as you're looking and paying attention, they're not doing any of this to any other genre of music. It's only allegedly the hip hop culture.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. And you mentioned that, and you, because you know you don't see any rock artists wearing no dresses. You don't see any metal acts wearing no dresses.
Yeah.
The raw essence of hip hop and when it was created, of course we already know it came from the sound of the street. That's because we didn't have a voice.
Right, right.
Now that hip hop has went mainstream and corporate, you know, that beauty of the hip hop is no longer gone. It's no longer there. Now it's about money. So they're gonna flip it, switch it. And like I said, hopefully, who knows? I mean, to think about it, you know, when you think about music, when you think about jazz, doo-wop, disco, R&B, usually genres of music do change every 20 years. You know, so
right.
Hip-hop had a real long, hip-hop in our form and what we know it as, had a very, very, very long run. So much of a run that I don't think you can do anything after hip-hop. They're meshing it, what they're doing, auto-tune and all kinds of other nonsense, but it's not that. It's not that hip-hop. We know that, you know. So I would love to be able to see somebody, you know, and be able to save that. The essence of hip hop, you know, we know LL has done something with his station and his music to keep, you know, the golden era of hip hop alive. And we just need more of it. We need more stations to play the traditional classical hip hop and then be able to mesh brothers like myself who rhyme the traditional classical way in today's present day to be able to be heard, because we have a generation of kids that need to know that the music that's being, you know, that they're listening to gets more in debt than just promoting party and drugs and, you know, gang violence and things of that nature.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's where a lot of times people try to look at hip-hop as a monolithic culture, and it's not. It's a multi-dimensional in terms of expression. Like you said, when you look at the, you know, from gangster rap with N.W.A., of course, Ice-T, you know, the MC8s, the DJ Quicks, when you get into the black, you know, the black power movement, of course, like you said, with X-Clan, Public Enemy, you know, Poor Righteous Teachers, you know, YZ, you know, it just, and even with the party, like Dana Dane, LL, you know, it just, it's beautiful in terms of what it was expressed as, but some people today still have a very narrow view of it in terms of they just look at it one way. And I'm like, no, it's a lot of different things.
Was like you did, yeah, like you touched on it back when it was in this glory day. Like you said, you had Gangsta, you had Sex Appeal, LL Cool J for the ladies. You had the native tongue music, your Tribe Called Quest and Jungle Brothers,
Queen Latifah.
Yeah, so you had so many different to where now, Mm-hmm. It's like a funnel. It's like a funnel. Yeah. Everything is just, everything sounds and looks the same. They've erased all originality. And when you, if you were to close your eyes and just listen to the radio, all these individuals they're saying the same thing, but just in a different, with on a different beat. I mean, it's just, it's hard to decipher who's who nowadays. Back in the day, you knew who was. I mean, when Heavy D came on the radio, you knew Heavy D. When you, I mean, you knew these voices; they were distinctive. Now,
right?
I don't know who's little this from little that. I mean, what are you kidding me? It's like.
And it's crazy, Pop, because me and King, I've said this many times, we talk off air, we've talked on air with many of our guests about it. When you look at how the game was predicated in its nascent forms, when it really rose to prominence in the mid-80s, you know, it was really about you doing something distinct that was going to set you apart. You know, when you look at LL, whether it was fashion, you know, you had LL with a Kangol. You know, I mean, you had Kumo D with the shades. I mean, you had KRS just with the street knowledge from the East Coast. Even with NWA, when they got into the 80s, you know, late 80s, in terms of Straight Outta Compton, they brought something that nobody else had ever spoken on wax like that. Everybody had something that really, really, really made them stand out. And that's what the culture was about, originality. Now it's like when you see how the music's being marketed, a lot of these artists, especially when you look at social media being a part of it, which has its good and bad points, you have artists out here now that are just looking for a quick way to get in. And like you said, Pop, you couldn't have put it any more better. Everybody's trying to find that formula to just jump behind they feel is popular. It doesn't matter if somebody's already out doing it. Hell, it doesn't even matter if the music's good or not. Their thing is, this is what everybody's doing. Let me get into it and try to find my quick way to fame instead of practicing and polishing and perfecting my craft.
Well, the industry is guilty for that, and I'm gonna let you know why.
Go ahead.
When they used to have the major labels and things of that nature, you get signed to a label, right? And remember,
right.
They'll do something like this. They'll say, you know what? Yo, Brown Hornet. Did you hear that new Trent song, right? Down with Old People. You gotta make a song like that. You think you can make a song that's like Down with OPP? Like you don't play with the POP or that's what they did. So a lot of individuals who were in the industry who probably didn't make it but said, you know what? I'm going to have an artist. We're just going to emulate what's already out there. And then that became a fad. And it was never about, then it became a later for originality. It became a CB4 type of thing. Remember when Chris Rock came out with CB4?
One of the greatest underappreciated comedies ever.
Yes, sir.
Man.
And when he came,
a pair of a black hat.
When he came out with CB4, me in my head, I was like, well, he just killed anybody trying to come out with. And then you had your Rick Rosses and your 50 Cents, and, you know, they took images and names or whatever, and they became big. You know what I mean? It was like he foreseen, you know, something that was like, or he seen what was really going on. And not to discredit, you know, 50 or Ross, but we know the real Rick Ross. We know there was a real 50 Cent. We know the real AZ. These dudes were street dudes, and he had these dudes take their name and flourish in the hip hop game. That just reminds me of CB4, full fledged. But and all these dudes, that's what they became now. He was successful with it. I'm gonna do the same thing. How do you make his voice sound? Yeah, do the same thing you did to his voice on my voice. That's where we're at with it. You know.
Yeah, man,
and to turn things back back to full throttle about you and everything. Now going back to your starting stage and getting into hip hop, man, like what was your inspirations in wanting to rhyme? Like, who was your musical inspirations?
I had so many musical inspirations, but if we leave it to hip hop, and we just leave it to hip hop real quick. I was a big Run DMC fan, and then from Run DMC, I went to KRS. And those two, I mean, you know, with everybody else involved, and Chuck D, I always felt like I had a heavy voice and a commanding voice like Chuck D. I always thought that Slick Rick was the greatest storyteller. I always thought KRS was had so many styles. I'm like a piggy bank, this is one penny. So from each individual, you know, I just figured maybe if I take a little bit of this and a little bit of that or whatever the case may be. But the show, if you got the showmanship of KRS and Run DMC and with the imagery, you know, because Run DMC were really our first hip hop all stars. You know, they're the first hip hop superstars, and I think their stardom is what made Hammer go hard to say, you know what, I want to be a superstar too. So those were good, healthy individuals, you know, just individuals to embody as a youngster. Just off the rip, those two stand out the most as far as hip-hop is concerned.
Definitely. And when you think about it, man, you know, that era, as they call, because depending on how you look at the history of it in terms of hip-hop, where some will say there are three golden eras, like in terms of the 80s, you know, in terms of like 88, and then some will say, you know, maybe the second golden era could be, you know, roughly about 94, 95. Go ahead, please.
This is where I'm going to cut you off at. There's only going to be one golden era. There's only one golden era, and that's the 80s. And reason being is this. This is the reason being. This is what the site is, and this is what cut through anybody's argument.
Right.
In the eighties, it was wordplay, and it was beautiful. I mean, the freaks come out at night.
Houdini,
you got a big mouth, boom. You got a big mouth, What? Let's do the jam called the Pee Wee Herman. But it was just fun. I'm playing basketball.
Basketball.
Yo, the '80s was so crazy with the diversity. The '90s came and it became the crack. It became the shoot 'em up. It became, you know, you know what I mean? You a shook one. It became Cash Rules Everything Around Me. It became, you know, not that the lyricism wasn't there, but I think that the industry, once the corporate hands touched it, it wasn't so golden no more. They utilized hip-hop and wanted to destroy it. And I think that that's what separates the golden era from any other era. And not that the golden era didn't have its Coogee raps, or it didn't have its what's my man down there in Philly? Because he's like the first, one of the first gangster raps. But you had your Ice-T,
Spoonie G.
So you had your handful of, you know, your gangsterisms, but you had a lot of artists that were so thoughtful. You know, you had your Public Enemies and Fight the Power. You had nothing matches that. Nothing in hip hop matches that. Nothing matches that. Nothing. And I love Nas, and I love all these great storytellers, but nothing moves you. You could throw it on. You throw on a Public Enemy track right now, and really nothing touches that. You throw on The Message, you know what I mean? And nothing really touches Melly Mel. Nothing touches these grandmasters. Nothing touches these people. And that's my opinion. I love Drake and what he's doing now, but that's not the hip-hop that we're talking about. That's not that golden era. That's not that when you listen to, you know what I mean? You got the chill. Boom, 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 boom.
EPMD, yeah.
It's certain, and not to even leave out the West Coast, because like I said, the Scarfaces, and we know Ice Cube, and, you know, I'm forgetting all of them. I know I'm being biased with the East Coast, but it just was different to me, you know? And nothing's going to touch that to me. Nothing.
And not to mention that even when they had the bridge wars, nobody got killed. It was straight lyrical warfare.
lyrical warfare, my brother, and it was lyrics, not some of this, you know. Now they talking, yeah, I'm gonna shoot you, kill. Hey, yo, but it doesn't. Is this? Ew, it's ugly. I'd be like, yo, oh my nephews and stuff, certain people. I'd be like, what are you? Are you serious? Are you serious?
And it's crazy,
yeah,
man.
It's
like
crazy.
King was saying, yeah.
Yeah,
like King was
crazy
saying,
because
man.
It's like KRS, because KRS and MC Shan, they can still hang out at the end of the day. The Ops
right,
can't
right.
hang out today.
And KRS, yeah. And KRS crushed his career, and still in all gave him a career, because Shan was still doing Sprite commercials. He was chilling with the Informer and all that. He was still eating. There was still money being made. You know, these dudes were still doing shows. They could still do shows. I mean, hip hop is just a beautiful situation. And when you have the Big Daddy Kanes and the KRS's and the Slick Ricks and the Dougie Freshes and all these dudes still on tour. I mean, you know, I mean, I see Rob Bass to this day. So it takes two to make a thing. I mean, he never stopped touring. I mean, those are classic songs. You can't replace those songs. You can't replace those, man.
Yeah.
And even the Nas's and the Redmans and the Ghost Faces and all that, they tell you the Ghost love Slick Rick, Capadonna, they love Slick Rick. You know what I mean? The Nas will tell you, no group was better than Run DMC. That's Queens all day. Like, you got to pay homage to the Golden Era.
Yeah, man.
That's
I
what
mean,
we try to do with our show, man, because. Yeah, I said that's what we do with our show, because I hate that the 80s get treated like a dinosaur era when the 80s, you know what I'm saying, pioneered all these styles that made the 90s flourish. You know what I mean?
Of course. Of course. Yeah, but of course.
Yeah, and I think sometimes there's that generation gap, y'all, because a lot of times when you look at that next generation, when you look at from the 80s to what were birthed in the 90s, like with Nas, Jay-Z, you know, all of them, you never hear any of them dismissing the legends that came before them. You know, they always give those
ever.
Calls. Even, you know, even when the Wu-Tang came in, you could see the Wu when they started. When all y'all, because all of y'all are collective, Wu affiliates, Wu-Tang, when all y'all started, y'all were an extension of the foundation that was laid, you know, by, you know, of course, KRS. You know, Slick Rick, you know, Kool Moe Dee, you know, Run DMC, you know, from the group, you know, from the group aesthetic to the subject matter, to the style, clothing, everything. You all were an extension of that carried on that proud tradition. But it's like some of these new rappers out now, they just act like they just did it themselves and like they don't have to pay homage to the ones who came before. The reason being is because
the struggle changed. When we were doing it, you know, you had to be in the club, you had to battle, you had to get your name out there in the street, you had to do all
outside.
These things. And you was outside. You really had to shake your ass. Now. You know, after Soulja Boy made the hit in the basement and spin out and did Superman, I mean, it's never been the same with it. It's never been the same. He changed the game.
Right. Take us back to that era, Pop, because all of you came up, you know, Staten Island and everything, you know, all the way from Brooklyn to everywhere. You know, the Wu was a network that was just astronomical with that movement. Take us through that time in the 90s when you kind of got an idea, when it all came, when all y'all started kind of commiserating about how y'all were going to take over hip-hop, and just from how it grew to what it eventually became.
Well, I'm going to tell you like this. I'm kind of like with you when it comes to really with the Wu. I kind of, also with the Wu-Tang Clan. I'm just the onlooker. I was really never part of the clan, and I'm not an affiliate. What I've always been was back in the days, I was part of the Wu-Tang movement. And once the Klan became the Klan, everybody else was just part of the movement. And then we kind of helped move the Klan to the next level. And once they kind of got to the next level, they never really kind of like looked back. They took and they kind of made a couple of main man groups like Sons of Man and Killer Army that was like their brothers and cousins and offspring, but they never really came to the grain like, you know, the Brown Hornets of the world or the King Justice or what have you. So we kind of looked, I'm like looking up and looking at them blow up and seeing them take the world by storm and the world gravitate towards them just the same way you did. So when I seen that happen, it was nothing but love and admiration because I seen something that started in my hometown become global, become worldwide.
Right.
And I was like, wow, something that really just manifested from out of Stapleton Projects, regardless of whom, you know, became a part of the movement and made it a global phenomenon, will always resonate. And my name being involved in the midst of things, I'll always appreciate that because, you know, that's just recognition and recognizing that I was part of the foundation when everything, before anything really went global and commercial, I was part of the beginnings.
And, I mean, for what you all contributed, I mean, how did you, I mean, hip-hop at that time, just tell us about what you felt about hip-hop in the East Coast during that time before that movement kicked and just how you felt like the music, do you feel like at that time New York was kind of, it was an extension of what you all were doing, or was it just New York was kind of stagnated and it needed some new infusion of blood to
energy.
Energy. Thank you.
Oh, we definitely felt like it needed some new blood. I mean, coming from out of Staten Island, the forgotten borough, we call it, you know, we used to call Staten Island the Rock. We used to call it the Rock. You know, you had to take the ferry to get to it. But we definitely had a chip on our shoulder because we, like I said, we didn't really have any representation during the glory days of hip-hop. Outside of the Force MDs, we didn't have anybody spitting bars. So us growing up, our hip-hop came on tape cassettes, so it came on Ralph McDaniel's MTV Raps and things of that nature. And we were all kind of growing up wanting to be seen on Video Music Box for MTV. We all had desires to say, you know what, I'm going to make it on to the, you know. So when the UMCs came out, the UMCs, you know, definitely threw fuel. They threw definitely fire underneath people's feet. A lot of people felt like, well, if the UMCs could do it, I could do it. You know, you had the Prince Rakim come there shortly thereafter. When he wasn't successful on Tommy Boy, that's when he kind of reinvented himself and he came back and he got some hardcore lyricists from the street. And I could have been part of them with the Wu-Tang Clan, but it wasn't my fit at that time. You know, I felt like there was better options for myself, and you know, I just stuck to my guns. But like I said, it's always fantastic to see individuals being successful coming out of Staten Island because we didn't have a voice before the Wu came out. Everybody kind of was like, you know, writing and wanting to be the next one up at the bat. You had your King Justice. You know, he came out during that era. He was a soloist. He was making noise, doing his thing at the time as well. So it was a fun time. I mean, it was fun and lyrical before the Klan got on and everything became more, corporate and commercial.
What did you learn about the business once? Okay, go ahead, King.
Hey, T-Maz, I gotta shoot him this one here because I've been wanting to ask you about this. I remember reading this a long time ago in one of my source issues back in the day, and it had Memphis Bleek on there, and he was talking about how him and his crew in the early 90s used to go to Staten Island and you know, the battle MCs, and he mentioned Shaheem, and he mentioned yourself. Now, is there any validity to that?
Oh, no, that's true. I mean, it wasn't really even him battling. He actually was, rest in peace to this, my brother named Salas, and Salas had a brother named Kayla that was from Marcy Projects, and he would come to Stapleton frequently. So, you know, when he go back, he was like, yeah, miss my man, you know, Jay-Z's man, I'm going to bring him out here and shit. So Kayla had brought Memphis out there, and Shaheem was on the come up, so they exchanged bars, and, you know, I was up at the studio, so, you know, I'm a little tad bit older, so he wasn't battling me, but we were definitely exchanging bars, and we was exchanging bars and things of that nature, so, yeah, nah, I remember reading that in the articles, too, so shout out to Memphis Bleek for keeping it. You'll always hear my name kicked around. I read a magazine one time, and Beanie Siegel, they asked Beanie, like, yo, who you used to listen to back in the days, and he mentioned my name, and I was taken by surprise by that as well. So I gather I had more impact on individuals than I really take credit for.
And that's dope, man, that, you know, they feel that, you know, that your name is so revered and respected. What was it like during those days just to see those guys come out there and just hang out and just trade bars, you know, and even though they were from a different, you know, borough, you know, you could come out there and it wasn't no problems. What was that feeling like during that time?
Well, you definitely had to have a pass. It wasn't like there was going to be any problems. You couldn't go to Marcy and stay within and fall kill in certain areas. That's the crack era. I call it the terror era. So you definitely have to have a pass. I mean, you know, the streets are wild now, but, you know, of course you knew the streets. Back then, you know, New York led, you know, with stupidity. It was like that was the capital of murders back during that time. So to be able to have my name, like you said, kicked around by individuals who made it, but when they talk about their street, you know, their street experiences and my name being there, you know, it just signifies that and clarifies and just more puts a stamp on it that, you know, I was there. Like Harris said, Just Ice, if I didn't say your name, that means I did not know you. If I did not know you, it was not there. You know, you have to say the Brown Hornet was there, baby. He was in the mix, you know.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times, Tupac, you know, when we look at that era, you know, like you said, in terms of how you really had to move and shake to make it quake, you know, in terms of your name back in the day, there's nothing that is a substitute for really being outside and really intermingling. You know, that was not a title to take lightly in terms of you were really certified out there. Do you feel a lot of times a lot of rappers now, how do you feel about where a lot of rappers are just falsely representing their past or their history to try to gain credibility in a game that is predicated on authenticity and creativity?
Yeah, well, you got to understand, it's not as easy as a job as it may seem or as it may look, you know. And when people are desperate or when they're looking for a way out, you know, they're figuring if he could do it, I could do it too. You're going to have a lot of music that, you know, probably shouldn't have been made, but cream always will rise to the top, you know, and, you know, that'll separate the boys from the men. Longevity, you know, it's relevant. I've seen it time and time again. You know, everybody wants to be the king of New York or everybody wants to be on top, but you have to have the total package. You made a valid point, like back in the days, you know, when you had your Heavy D or you had your Slick Rick or you had your LL or you had your Big Daddy Kane, or everybody had a signature look, you know. So that also plays a very heavy part in being a standout superstar. A signature look with a signature sound. And if hip-hop gets back to that, you know, I think that, you know, we'll be, they say things go back and there's 360s to it. So if we apply pressure and we have the real lyricists come out and hopefully maybe get some support from however, be it underground stations or whatever, but there has to be some, you got to think about it like this. That the music that's getting played had its start, you know, and who pushed it. And the same way they pushed it, you have to say, you know what, this real hip-hop is not ready to die yet. You're going to push this, and this is what should be heard. And I think this is what, you know, the next generation, we should be giving our generation food for thought. You know, we have to start learning how to cook with the stove instead of just popping something in the microwave and feeding it to our kids. Because that's really what's happening. They're getting microwavable hip-hop, microwavable rap treat. In 2 minutes is ready. Back in the days, you used to have to go to the lab and make hits. So hopefully, you know, maybe that's what we see in real authentic classic hip hop.
Hey, now, I was going to ask you this here, man, because somebody just submitted me this question here. Then after that, I'm going to let T-Mac submit his question. Now, You brought up New York, and you know that era being the terror era, right? And we also had some special moments within the culture, especially in the 90s when you had the Freaknicks for Atlanta. Man, you need to let us know about the tunnel, how crazy that joint was in the 90s in New York City.
Yeah, the tunnel was it was marvelous. I mean, it was one of those experiences. I mean, not even one of them. I stayed in the tunnel religiously. But when you went into the tunnel and they had, you know, the party was always jumping, and then whoever you seen performing there, Busta Rhymes, a big pun. I've seen so much talent really rock out of the tunnel, and the crowd will go crazy. I was in there one time. LL came out and put out the ball. I mean, I'm glad I had my drink and, you know, my bottle already, because when he brought out the ball, I mean, the girls just flooded. I mean, that thing looked like it was packed about an hour and a half. But it was just so much. It was so chaotic inside the tunnel. And then, you know, the bathrooms were unisex. And so it was definitely a lot of things going down in that tunnel.
Yeah, and I mean, it definitely was a staple that you really had to be certified going through there. With what the New York era brought in terms of the 90s.
Have any of you guys ever been to the tunnel before?
Nah. Well, we wish we could have lived those days, man.
No, none of you guys went to the tunnel, huh? Ooh. Yeah, that's when Flex, you know, that was his house, whatever the case may be. But, yo, I mean, you can't even, this era doesn't even know what partying is about. You go to these parties now, they're dancing with their phone, they're doing Snapchat. I mean, they don't even know what a reggae party was, a basement reggae party back in the day. Remember a basement reggae party
man.
Back then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pop, we hear the enthusiasm in your voice, man, in terms of it. But because we were shorties back in the day, you know, me being raised in Virginia, King being from
16.
North Carolina. Yeah, so we was young niggas, man. So it's like we really, 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 like, we heard the stories, but we really, like, you know, we just really couldn't, you know, we always respected it. Because y'all had set the bar, but for us to live it, we didn't. But we knew, you know, because God bless us, we met a lot of people along this journey of Off the Cuff. And they told us stories about how wild the tunnel was. Like, King always gives me a good laugh. We say, like, niggas would bring in grenades, you know, handguns, right? Like, it was a jungle back in the day. Was it really like that on that day?
Have anybody got inside to the tunnel back then like that, that means they was well connected.
Right.
I mean, trust me, they used to be, you used to go in the tunnel, it felt like you probably was going to prison because the bouncers would be long as hell. You had to take off your sneakers, click them, they'll check them, boom, boom. I mean, there was always a will, there was a way, but there was always individuals who might have knew a bouncer or two or whatever the case may be. You know, shout out to Sherlock.
Right.
I mean, the big bouncer holding it down. I was like, fam, Sterling, my bad, Sterling. Shout out to Sterling. He was the main bouncer back then but yeah, if they got in with that, trust me, they knew somebody because it was like going up in a correctional facility when you was going up in the tunnel. Trust me, and then when they threw you out, when the bouncers threw you out, You got beat out. You see about 10. Boop, beep, 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 boop, 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 boop. Boom, you got tossed out. And that was the way you got thrown out the tunnel. It wasn't no nice way out or whatever. You got manhandled and you got beat out. You know what I mean? That's how
they
you got
dare
that's
you
how
come. They dare you start some static trying to come back.
Oh, man. I mean, they had some big to do. Everybody that got cut up, everybody that didn't make the team in the NFL was bouncing at the tunnel.
Oh, man.
You got cut for the team, but you got a job.
Yeah, you got a job. Had about 20 shift, had about 30 shift nights out there. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's hilarious. But that's wild, man. I mean, but that's something that, you know, and I think a lot of times when we think about the Big East back in the day in terms of the aesthetic show, it just really had a certain feel. Like New York was just like that, is, you know, as we have a joke where we mean it respectfully, the old New York, like, you know, the, like you said, the AZ Faison, you know, the Guy Fisher, you know, all of those guys, it was like, you know, of course, King, you know, Supreme Team, you know, all those guys, like, it was just a certain era, you know, just what was going on back in the day. You know, Rich Porter, you know, the Paid in Full, you know, it was just what did it mean to be in the streets of New York during that time, not even being an artist, but just being out there and just experiencing everything and just watching other artists like on their grind making it, because you obviously saw a lot of guys outside the Wu who were on their hustle to get there. Who did you see along the way during that time y'all making y'all come up that you all knew and was like, yo, this dude like has a chance to do it, or this girl got a chance to do it?
Let me think. One that sticks out to me is Foxy Brown. I remember it was before Foxy Brown was Foxy. Before she was Foxy Brown, she was Inga. That's what I think, like, Inga was her real
name.
And she used
Inga Marshawn, yeah.
Right. And I think she used to call herself, she had a different name, because when she signed the Capitol Records at the time, and she had a certain manager, and I remember her mother. Her mother was like, you know, always, she looked very, she reminded me of like maybe like Biggie. You know, they was from the islands. They were, you know, whether they was Jamaican or whatever they was. So, but I remember Inga. I remember Inga, and she was looking for a name. She didn't have a name at that time. She wasn't called Foxy Brown. And Hun Shaheen was in the studio a lot of times, and that's why when she first came out, a couple of people was like, "Yo, she sounds like Shaheen in one of rhymes," because I think Foxy really, you know, whoever she rhymes with, I think she could sound like, you know, at the beginning stages. But I knew her before she blew up. I seen her blow. I was like, oh, you know, I seen her a couple of times after that. It was always love when I bumped into her. So, I mean, it was always a beautiful thing to see that. But I've seen so many. I remember being in the studio before Big Pump, who used to be on Staten Island a lot with Fat Joe. That used to be down there on like 29 Bay Street, 26 Bay. It was like a digital recording studio down there. What's her name used to be in there a lot? Mariah Carey. So I bumped into a lot of artists. be it the Mob Deeps and be it the Dead Presidents. I remember being in the van. I remember when Shaheen was on Virgin, and I remember when Shaggy had first signed the Virgin. And it's ironic, we was on a road with them, and we was at the Freaknik, and he was when he first came out doing one of his songs. I forget the first song he had, but I remember
on
being in the van with him. Maybe it was on it. Well, that was Shaheem had On and On, but did Shaggy have On and On too?
Yeah. Well, Shaggy. Cool. Oh, Shaggy about Boombastic, Boombastic.
Oh yeah, the Boombox thing. Yeah, I think he had that. He might have had that
right.
At the time. Yeah, yeah. But he was on. You know, we was on the road together with him before anybody knew who he was. I didn't even know what mm-hmm. Shaggy. I was just like, and when he blew up with what me and all that, I'm like, this motherfucker. I mean, so. Like I said, I could name so many, man. It's so because remember the Freaknik used to have so many different artists coming through there, and the Jack the Rappers and things of that nature. You know what I mean?
Damn, they don't even have a Jack the Rapper no more.
Down there in New Orleans and Texas and all of that used to be down there in the dirty,
Look, dude, look, Pop, we got, seeing you said Freaknik, because we have heard many, 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 many stories about Freaknik. How wild
are
you doing that or not?
Oh, God, man. Are you serious? I mean, the Freakniks were fabulous. I mean, I never seen so much blackness in my life. And it wasn't no stompies, no shootouts, no nothing. I mean, they came here to do what they came. If you couldn't get no ass down there, I don't know what you might as well do with yourself. It was just a little waffle house. I mean, I'm telling you, you break at dawn, like you get out there 3-4 in the morning on Peachtree, and you be walking down the avenue. You'd be kicking the video, and the weather felt good. The sun always felt, dude, you bring back those memories, man. I'm telling you, everything was tasting good back then.
Dude, because we, look, Pop, because we heard the stories, like, it's like, in terms of the pimp game, it's like, they was like, dude, this is how crazy it was. They were like, you didn't necessarily have to have a hotel room. They were like, you could find a shorty within 30 minutes of getting there, and she have a whole bunch of friends. You could be by yourself or have a whole bunch of your homies with you. The next thing y'all know, y'all got a room with them, and y'all stay the rest of the time.
Just like that.
No, it was just like that, especially if you had game. I mean, back then, if you had game and then you was walking around with that hydro, some weed or whatever, and we had rooms. First of all, you go down there, them rooms are sold out. But, those were some extravagant, filled times because there wasn't enough hotel rooms to accommodate everybody that was coming down from all these different states, the colleges, the this, the that. I mean, it was flooded. You got North Carolina. So I remember when we used to drive into it because I've been to a couple of them. I mean, just to drive into these states to whereas you was online trying to get in for 2 hours and then the music and then your time for the percolator, everybody just shaking their head, drop what your mama gave, all of that shit, come on, the answers just jump out, doing the butt, whatever. I don't care what they played. What happened to those times? What the fuck happened? Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and they're talking about bringing it back. But we were like, me and King were like, we heard about it. No, it ain't going to be the same. You just can't duplicate that type of energy that was there back in the day in terms of where the culture was,
Because you know how the Freaknik was set up, too. The Freaknik was set up down in Atlanta that you could perform on one stage. There'd be so many people. You might perform on one stage at 1 o'clock, and then you got to perform on this other stage at 3. And your whole time you be trying to get, the whole 2 hours, you trying to get to the other stage that might be on the other side or whatever. But there was always more that like that Freakney was set up different. There'd be so many different stages. It wasn't like everybody just performed on one stage. It'd be a party right. overhead, there's something jumping overhead, and there was something jumping overhead. That's why it was like a 2-day, 3-day event. It wasn't no 1-day. I don't even know how they ran that functionally. And then it used to be one in Philly, too. So it used to be Philly to Atlanta to Texas, New Orleans, you know what I mean? Florida. I'm thinking Florida had a couple of them as well.
They had Black Beach Week in Florida, you know, Daytona, you know, Fort Lauderdale, you know, Miami. I mean, when you look at that time, what was going on, I think Luke, because Luke had a teen club down there at the time. I forget the name, but he also had Club Rolex at the time, too. I think that's when he owned a strip club and a teen club. But that's like during that time when Miami was like just, you know, when you look at that time, because, of course, when we look at the party scene, Pop and King, this is the time when you know, New York was already, we already know New York was established on the rap scene and the West Coast was doing their thing. But when you wanted straight party, fun times, Atlanta and Miami was just the places you had to go. Like, that's where you wanted to go if you just wanted to just cut loose
right.
and just get crazy.
A little bit of DC, you know, before DC got turned down. You can go to DC, too.
True, the go-go movement. Shout out to Junkyard Band, Backyard Band. You know, rest in peace, Chuck Brown, you know. I mean, it was just, yeah. You know, but just listen to that enthusiasm you reckon in your recollection, man. I mean, you know, we would see, if, you know, this is the time before social media. Shout out to Source Magazine, of course, faithful reader since 1994. When they would have pictures of, like, you know, pictures from Freaknik, you know, back in the day. And, I mean, you know, you're just seeing this as a young kid, and you're like, oh, my God, to just live in Atlanta, to just be there, you know, and just, you know, I mean, all the HBCUs, Clark Atlanta, Spelman, you know, Morehouse, you know, it's like, man.
It felt like the culture was out. It felt like it was owned by us and done by us.
Yes, absolutely.
It was crazy one time. On one of our performances, I was a hype man for Shaheem, right? So this went on and on, and one for the money, and we was doing things like that. Well, we did the Freaknik, we turned it out. Mm. It was live when we came off the stage. Biv was right there. Bill was like, oh, yo, man, y'all killed it or whatever. He's like, yo, y'all killed it. And he's like, true. As we walking down the stairs to get off the stage, guess who's coming up?
Mm-hmm. Who that?
Biggie. Boom, 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 boom.
Oh, wow.
So we got off the stage. We got on the stage before Biggie got on the stage on one point. Yeah, man, I you know. They was even back, you know, they was behind stage with us. They had, they was like, I never forget, it was Shaheem's manager, Guy, Shaheem and myself, and then it was Biggie, Puffy, and about 50 other goons. They was crazy deep, you know what I mean? So, after we did the show, we got on, Brooklyn, yo, big, yo. And you already know the house came down after when he toured. You know what I mean? But these
did
are,
y'all know?
These are,
go ahead. I'll ask after you say. Go ahead.
Nah, but these are just, you know, these are just the memories that resonate in your head. You know, you've seen individuals before they really became super, super mega stars. You know?
Definitely. Did you all know about Big? You know, Brooklyn before that show, in terms of what he was doing, in terms of like where he was headed with it?
Oh yeah, of course. You know you heard of Big, and definitely at that time when we was doing it,
mm-hmm.
You gotta remember, you know, Shaheem, he was on the track with Tupac and Big, courtesy of Big Daddy Kane, you know, so it wasn't like they didn't know of each other. Yeah, it wasn't like they didn't know of each other.
Yeah, from 1994,
but, you know,
yeah.
And Shaheen, it was a good, you know, you seen Shaheen, the littlest MC in New York out there holding his own, you know, holding his own out there with the big dogs. So,
I remember that album. That was the Daddy's Home album that Kane dropped in 94, as a matter of fact. I think a lot of times, and this is why we do shows like this, Pop, because, you know, to really, you know, have those stories told from somebody who was there, it's a portal to the past of such a simpler time in terms of when the parties, you know, there was shit going on in the 90s. We know that. But, you know, to see, you know, and I don't want to be a pessimist about it, you know, but it's like when you think of that era, like you said, man, you know, you could have a Freaknik where all black people came together. They would say the estimates could be around 100 to 150,000 college students from all over the country coming there. And it was, you never really heard of anything in terms of even over 30 years later. You never hear of one incident in Freaknik that was just so violent or just so bad that it stained the whole movement. It's like, I have yet to hear anything about it.
Let me tell you.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Let me tell you.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Don't think, you know, there was violence that broke out, you know, but there was nothing like, you know, mass killings, probably somebody gets shot at it.
Right, that's my point.
I remember, and this is true, back to the situation, we was with Shaggy. We was in the van, I think it was definitely Shy, myself, Shaggy, his homie, and another group or something, but we were strolling out late night, Peachtree, it was jam-packed. You know, the streets was jam-packed, boom, the cars was moving slow. But you remember down in Atlanta, they got the right to carry down there. The gun laws is different.
Right.
This dude pulled out a gun. Some stunt, it must have been a semi-stunt. And he just lets it off. Yo, must have been like a quick 13, 15 shots. But the shit was so loud.
Damn.
You know, and the streets, yeah, he let it off like bah, 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 but he didn't let it off at nobody. He let it up in the sky. But everybody was running for crazy. But the cops, you know, they surrounded him and they threw him in cuffs or whatever. But I remember that day, it just stands out because we was in so much traffic, there was nowhere we could drive. Like, you know, the shots went off and all we could do was really get down low inside the van because it was it was just too much traffic. But I said to myself, like, you know, it was fun as hell, but it was also dangerous because like I said, you in certain states like Georgia, they get the right to conceal weapons. You know what I mean? So, you know,
yeah,
I think that always kept people at bay. You know, they say southern comfort and hospitality. And that's because everybody got one. You didn't just want to be easy, but I remember a couple of outbreaks. But like you said, it was nothing crazy. You know, they just had the situation in hip hop where, you know, where 8 people passed away. I think, and they always talk about
Travis
the situation.
Yeah, Travis Scott, Astroworld. Yeah.
Right. You know, you got certain situations in hip hop, but like you said, for the most part in the Freaknik, you know, it was never anything major tragic. Every Freaknik I've been to was always successful, you know.
Yeah.
Now,
for
a minute, and I was saying switching gears for a minute. And this was around the time where you guys was putting out your debut album, the GP Wu album. Why was there not a follow-up to that? Because curious minds wanted to know because, you know, you guys put out a dope product out there, and then after that, it just, like, nothing else followed up.
Well, in a nutshell, when we had signed to MCA, Down Low Records, other bands, June Lover, myself, we were very hard at being GP the Green. We wanted to have our own identity, and at the last minute, Hank Shockley decided that he wanted to call us GP Woo, and that never really stuck good with the group. We never wanted to be GP Woo. We always wanted to be GP mm-hmm. the Grain. But I think once he heard the history and that, you know, us as GP,
he's like, don't go against the Grain.
Yeah, once us GP like the Grain, once he understood that, you know, that GP and Wu-Tang really had it start out in Stapleton, he kind of took it, you know, he took it. I always felt like Hank Shockley and RZA had a good new relationship. You got to remember they had did All I Need, you know, Meth and Mary, which was a Grammy-winning song. So, you know, I think in hindsight, Hank Shockley wanted GP to do or get a lot of, you know, beats from RZA. We were kind of reluctant to do so. And so with that being said, it wasn't like his Wu-Tang part of the deal wasn't following through. And, you know, he kind of was reluctant. He kind of just told us, like, you know, y'all can do the second album, but we're not going to be heavily supportive of it. So me, I was just more or less like, well, if you're not going to support it, you might as well just drop us. I'm not going to do an album. You know, we gave you a hot album because we always felt like they fumbled the ball with that. They didn't give us the greatest support. And, you know, MCA was more of a R&B label. We just figured that, you know, with that star power that they had, if they would have gave GP a solid effort and shot instead of, you know, shuffling their feet, it could have been a beautiful thing. You know, individuals at that time definitely had the hunger to be competitive in the game. You know, we definitely thought we brought something different to the table at that time as well.
Definitely, Pop, and that, I guess,
you know, but you know, right? Okay. But just the, you know, not to cut you off, but I think just the fact that, you know, after we did the first album and we didn't get too much of a great support, and then it was, you know, kind of like, you know, back then we knew what being a tax write-off and all of this was, and I didn't know, I didn't want to go through the ringer with this conglomerate. It would have been beautiful if he would have came and said, you know, we'll be supportive and we're going to, you know, push these singles and we're going to, you know, make it happen. But I think that, you know, the course ran itself.
Definitely, Pop. And one thing about that's a perfect segue for the next question. We wanted to ask you, what did you learn in the aspect of business in terms of how the record industry works, in terms of the politics and, you know, people who are involved and making sure that they have your best interests at heart? And how do artists today coming in need to understand what they're getting into in the industry in that capacity?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure the game is a lot different than it was back then. You had to deal with, you know, you had to deal with a lot of egos. You had to deal with your label mates and so forth and so on. A lot of people coming out now, you know, they're coming out independently. You know, they're getting a lot of leeway to, whereas, like we hit on, you don't have to really earn your stripes. I mean, you can make a hot song in your basement, spit it out there. If it catches fire and goes viral, you made it. You know, that it's different now than it was back then. So I don't even, you know, I don't know if even the information that I obtained in the industry is even worthy of these young cats even wanting to pay attention to, because they're seeing it in a whole different fashion. But what I did learn is the fact that priority, you know, make yourself a priority in your own life, because in these labels, once they have, if they have 10 artists, there's only 3 or 4 of them that's really their priority. That's their priority. That's going to be their bread and butter, these 3-4 artists. Anything else is something that we'll work on, and if it pans out and it sticks, we'll keep it afloat. If not, if it shows any kind of resistance or reluctance or whatever, it's a tax write-off and we can keep it pushing. So it's a very cold business. There's no feelings. You got to have tough skin. You got to be built to endure a lot of doors to be slammed in your face. You know, I don't think anybody's going to put you on. You got to put yourself on. And that'll be my main thing to tell anybody who wants to get into it. Don't look for anybody to put you on. Put yourself on. You know, what people fail to realize is that the next individual isn't going to really help you get to where you got to go because he doesn't want you to take his spot or his slot. You know, once these people have their slot, they're trying to keep it. They're not trying to lose it. So to these up-and-coming artists, you know, be versatile. Try to have some originality to your resume. Originality, versatility, and a signature look. Those are the three things.
Yeah, man. And, you know, that's real because a lot of times artists come in and they think that there is this easy pathway to it, especially in this age of the social media where a video can go viral and take you to notoriety. We said it once on this show, we will say it again, you know, but, you know, going viral doesn't mean that you're a viable artist. It just means you have something catchy, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's substantial, you know, because then it turns into, are you going to be known for being a novelty or do you really have real talent that is going to outlive the hype? And what have you seen today in terms of the marketing about how artists are going about it in terms of marketing their music? Because back in the day, you all really had to get it on the grip in terms of having real talent, having real hustle. And now it just seems like now, you know, pretty much, like you said, a lot of artists are putting themselves on and are just promoting themselves. How do you think it would have been during that time you all came up if social media was available back then?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I'm glad I don't even know. I'm glad there wasn't even social media back then. But to have it now and know what it means in this present day, it kind of means the world because to be able to be independent and have creative control of your music, that's being free. You know, when you was on to these labels, they want to critique. You know, they want to do too much. And sometimes you just feel like they were out of tune with what hip-hop. Sometimes an artist wants to take things in a different direction. You got your Kanye's of the world, and you know, hip hop has become so artistic that individuals have their own definition of what hip hop is, and I don't think that's something that should be bottled. But when you're signed to a big conglomerate, that's what happens. They want to. You know, there might be some. You know, every artist isn't gifted like that. There are artists that do need artist development, you know, so, you know, some of those labels were important because you don't have artist development now. You don't have anything. You have a bunch of copycats, but back then, you know, there was a system to help you succeed to where that's not heavily relevant and prevalent in these days. But to have the free range and artistry and creative control to make what you want to do what you want to do. In this present day, I just think that's priceless. I think that's beautiful. You know, to be able to sell your own music, how music is about to go into another dimension with these what do you put in music on? Tory Lanez, what was that?
RTS.
What is that called again?
I think it's called RTS.
No, I don't think it's called RTS, but it's something close to that. But it's along those lines. But, you know, like I said, music industry is forever growing. And if you have independent artists, and we're about to get into the Bitcoin generation, and we got these cyber worlds being created, and the NRTs, that's what he put it on, right? NRT, I think. Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. I got the letters wrong.
Yeah. So, but this is the new ways being generated to generate capital and funds. Imagine being an artist and these NRTs, you don't know where they're going to go, but, you know, you got your own platform to put it out to generate money, you know. Being signed to a label, having a 360 deal, these people will be owning your NRTs and everything. I mean, yeah, I just think that the business opened up a lot wider, and it gives artists a wider range on how they want to maneuver in business. I just think, you know, during this 80s and 90s, there was just one way of doing it, and that was to be signed to somebody, we'll pull it out. You might get 5 to 10 cents off your record. You'll get mechanical check. You know what I mean? But you're getting raped. I mean, it's just, like I said, when Soulja Boy came out, you know, and he used to look up to Bow Wow, and he say he went and bought this car because Bow Wow had it, but that was just a rental, but he owned his. You know, there's just certain things that happen along the line. Once he did that, Soulja Boy, he changed the game, and I think what Tory Lanez did with the NRTs is we living in a time where it's about to change again. So we just got to pay attention to it and capitalize off the inner jewels of hip hop, because the mainstream is not really letting everybody in. So we have to find ways within the system, you know, to find that pot of gold.
Yeah, and you know, it's wild. I think that's why when we look at this new generation pop, I think that's when we look at groups like Griselda, of whom I've been a unabashed and fervent fan of them. I think that's why it's so refreshing to see what Griselda is doing. Shout out to Benny Conway, City Boy, you know, Westside, Armani, Boldy, you know, Rick Hyde, you know, all of them, man. I mean, it's just that movement that they have established, you know, for so many years, and of the past five have really, you know, put a, you know, they've just carved out and just sat in the throne of their own space. I mean, you know, bringing back that vibe that is so refreshing, is so reminiscent of that, you know, 90s era, that early 2000s era of hip-hop. And they are, and to just see them do it themselves with really no major cosign, you know, just hard work, just doing it out of Buffalo, you know, where previously it was known for Rick James and Buffalo Wings, you know, outside the Bills. And, you know, what do artists have to understand about in terms of getting your movement, in terms of really establishing it? Because a lot of artists aspire, Pop, to be global, but how, from you, what you observed with your experience and knowledge, how does that apply to getting your hometown before you really, really can go global, in terms of really your hometown recognizing you and respecting you?
I don't think that's really necessary. It's like it's a head and a tail. You could definitely make it with home support.
Right.
But then I think there's superstar status, to whereas if you're a global artist, you spit something to the universe, and I think that people from outside could gravitate towards it and make it big. That's when your hometown will really embrace you, because they see that other people acknowledge who you are. You grew up with these people all your life. When you grow up with people all your life, they have a tendency just to be like, you know, you could play them that hot track. 10 years from now, that track, you could put it out and it'll blow. You know what I mean? And once it blows, then it's like, oh,
oh, that song, yeah, he used to play that shit all the time. Yeah, I always told him it was a great song.
You know, not that they believed in you, but you have to first believe into yourself. The only way the hometown is going to believe in you is you have to first believe in yourself. Once you show that ultimate belief in yourself, then and only then can your hometown really support and believe in you, because they know that you've been battle tested. You know, and that's how I really believe and truly believe that it goes. You have to, because the hometown will embrace you and support you once they know that you've embodied the hometown, and now you're moving with the confidence of a homegrown hometown. You know, you've embodied the hometown, and now you're moving with that confidence because you know that the hometown is behind you. So even if you walk in the streets by yourself, you know, you're confident in yourself because you already know you have the support of thousands. That's how your mind state is supposed to be.
Yeah, and that's real. You know, one thing about doing this show, we've talked to so many people over the years. We've met so many people. And when I watch independent movements from the East Coast to the West Coast, you know, one thing, you know, because we are journalists and part of our job is watching who is up next. We've been blessed to get a lot of artists
back,
you know, up and coming, you know, who have really been able to, like, really do some big things. But one thing about it is, and I tell artists this, you know, King will tell them this, especially with his journalism background, when your music gets outside of your area and other people are rocking your shit, when you got people on, you know, Twitter or Facebook or IG and they're playing your shit or they're showing off your album that they bought, I'm like, that, my nigga, is when you know you've made it, when you've got people outside your area that are recognizing it. And, you know, it shows that you've gotten outside your area, like people, because one thing, King and Pop, you know, we've all seen it. You know, some artists are okay being local in terms of being celebrities because it's not a lot of work, you know, and it's like they want to feel like they're the man or woman in their town. But I'm like, if you want to be locally famous, that's fine. But if you want a true testament to how your shit reaches and touches people, you're going to have to jump out on that leap of faith and see how your music is tested. Because on one hand of it, there are certain markets like Atlanta, L.A., New York, Miami, where there's an infrastructure there that is already set. So you can be big there, and you don't necessarily have to be big anywhere else. But the market there facilitates a good living for you. It facilitates celebrity notoriety. Some places, it's like, dude, if you're really going to be that guy or girl, you got to get outside of there, and you got to make a dent wherever you go next.
Yeah, that's difficult.
It is. It is, because not everybody gravitates it. Yeah.
That's not an easy task.
It isn't. But when you can break through and when you're booking shows in other places and you're packing them out, that is when you can say, like, you really have a following. You know,
yeah,
we look at...
Yeah, that's when you, like,
you know,
you really have a following. Because you might get five people from your hometown to be true road warriors with you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, how does it feel to be a kid from Virginia to drop a single and, you know, you got somebody from Jersey or Boston or, you know, New York or Michigan singing your song? I mean, it can't get bigger than that. You know, you would expect your hometown to be chanting it, but once you hear it from outside, you know, they said once the white people start coming to your concerts, you made it, you know.
Yeah.
That's how it was back in the day. That's how it was.
Yeah, but that's something when you know about when you look at how you have artists you know, like Mitchie Slick, you know, shout out Southeast San Diego, Onondaga, Vaughn Kind, you know, Linkin Park, you know, those are my folk out there. And I remember seeing Mitchie with his Triggeration Station. That was profiled in a 2003 issue of The Source. And that's how, now this is, mind you, this is about a couple years before Facebook really got out there and about 3 or 4 years before Twitter came out. and way before IG came. So this was like, you know, you were reading the magazines, you know. You know, I was reading y'all record review in the Source and Double XL years back, you know. But if you got in there, that was the publications that really, really were like, if you were up and coming, you were bubbling, that's how you knew you were getting there when the publications came in place. From your estimation, Pop, how has it changed in terms of print literature for magazines to where a lot of things are digital? How important do you think it is to still have the magazines out there for people to still have in their hands, as well as physical copies of albums, to have that tangible element of really having a memento, a souvenir of somebody's work and a documentation of that work as well?
I mean, I do miss it. You know, I miss the magazines. I miss the hard copies and things of that nature. Like you said, just the, the artwork and just the reading the words and opening up the album covers. I come when I was a shorty, and them albums would come. You flick those albums open, your mom's, grandma, whatever, and you see the artistry or you see the lyrics written down. I remember Michael Jackson, the Thriller, is off the war album, had all the lyrics, and I used to play that song over and over and try to, you know, sing those songs with the lyrics, man. I just thought that was so fly. And this generation know nothing about it. These kids growing up, all they have is a digital world. They never seen a hard copy. They don't know what a disc is, a CD, or anything. So yeah, I mean, we classic individuals. We've seen it, but there's nothing like having wax or nothing like having a CD. I gather it's very convenient, this digital world, but I definitely missed it. I used to collect men magazines. I got a stack of them, man. I used to have Buffy the Body and all these other ones. You know what I mean? I still got the magazines stacked up.
I still got them stacked up
somewhere. But now, you know, I got Instagram and TikTok. And those asses, you know, now they shake now. They used to be still pictures.
It's wild, man. I mean, because interaction, how has social media been for you, Pop, in terms of being able to interact with your fans, you know, on a more personal basis, talking to them directly?
I mean, that aspect of it, man, I love. I didn't have social media until about 5 years ago. So, and that's when I did the album with King Just, the Emperor, the Best of Both Hoods, the Emperor and the King. We did the mixtape, and when I did it, I said, you know, I'll probably have to do start opening up a Facebook and things of that nature, because I'm out of tune. I don't know what's going on as far as, you know, social media is concerned. But I remember my lady had made me make a page, and you know, she's like, don't nobody know you. She might have had however many friends she had on Facebook at the time, but the next day I had about 900 requests, friend requests.
Oh, wow.
It was like, what? You know what I mean? It was just people from all over, like, yo, but all over. I mean, I got, and, you know, it just opened my eyes, you know, when people I'm reading statements like, you know, that black on black, and it changed my world. You know, people from Brazil, they just like, yeah, that's one of the best hip-hop songs I've ever heard. And, you know, I'm looking at it like, wow, like, you know, kind of in the blind when you sign the major labels, you don't get to touch the art, you know, you don't get to touch the fans, you don't interact with these DJs, you don't do all these things. It's like whatever they set you up for, or whatever their publicist has aligned for you, that's what you hear or that's what you see. But with the social media, it's just like a floodgate of, you know, diehard fans and everything came and voiced their opinion. So I think that the social media aspect of it is definitely a beautiful thing.
I'll tell you one thing. It definitely makes it easier for us because, you know, back in the day, man, I mean, when you look at how We have camera phones. You know, we have computer programs in terms of video for editing and all that. I mean, this is stuff 25 years ago, 30 years ago, that would have just been unfathomable. I mean, shooting a video back in the day was like a really big deal considering the camera equipment you had to have, you know, and now you can shoot it off of your phone or you can get a computer program for all of that editing. Even being able to do a show like this, interviewing legends like yourself, you know, I mean, it's really made it a lot easier in that capacity, man. And for that, technology, like anything in the wrong hands, isn't good. But when it's used right, it opens up a world of opportunities. I mean, we could have never thought years ago that we could have this type of dialogue, this type of, you know, wisdom being passed, you know, talking to people we grew up listening to. And that, for that, we are blessed. We are humbled. We are appreciative.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is something. Pretty much as you – so tell us about the King Just Project. How did that come together?
Well, me and King Just have a history with each other as far as, you know, him being from Paul Kill, me being from Stapleton. So we both live in a 10304 zip code.
Killer Hill.
Yeah, in Stapleton. So – you know, we went to high school. I'm a couple of years older than KJ, but he used to, you know, in high school, he used to run up on me and spit his rhymes, and you know, I spit some rhymes back, and we had a healthy you know, competitiveness towards each other since back then. So, we went our separate ways as far as music was concerned. And who he was dealing with when he came out with the Black Fist and the A-Yahoos and all of that. So to make a longer story short,
his drum and all
you know, we kind of was both on a long hiatus, and through the fact we was always cool and chill with each other, was nothing to say. You know what? Let's blow the dust off the mics. Let's make something. Let's see if we can make something transpire out of it. So, you know, we collab together. Him being King Jess, my first solo album was The Underground Emperor. So that's the Best of Both Hoods. I'm from Stapleton. He's from Park Hill. So Best of Both Hoods, The Emperor and the King. That's how we came up with the title of it, simplified it, you know, and put some good work together. Great album for individuals who haven't heard it, you know. The Best of Both Hoods, The Emperor and the King.
Absolutely.
Yeah, man. That's dope. That's dope. And I got another question that was shot to me. Now, we all see what's going on with Hulu with the whole Wu-Tang series, and it's getting a lot of critical acclaim. And you coming from that era, and you coming from Staten Island, man, do you see that as a good representation of what Staten Island is and as a true accurate of how Wu-Tang was moving?
I've never watched it, so I couldn't tell you. But I'm going to tell you one thing. If it never mentioned Brown Hornet in it, it's probably not true.
You got you.
Got it.
Got you. And one thing
put
about
you in
it,
season
Tom,
three.
Yeah, man. Look,
I mean, yo, if I wasn't in season one, you know I'm not going to be in season three. But let me tell you something. I pre-exist the Wu-Tang Clan. I was rapping on Staten Island, since the Park Villa. I was a 15-year-old underage individual up in Park Villa, you know. And me and Capadonna, back then he was just OG. I was Bobby Brown Hornet. He was a couple of years older than me, but there was a dude named Dusty who threw a party in Park Villa. And I had won the battle, and I was really a no-name, so they was like, go get OG, who later on becomes Capadonna. And he comes in maybe like 10 minutes later. We had to wait for him to come in. He spit his rhyme, and the crowd went crazy. And then Dusty was like, battle, you two got the battle. So I said a verse, he said a verse, and there was a tie. The winner was supposed to get $100, but we wound up winning $50. Yeah, a lot of history, and you won't see that in the Hooping series, but this is a true story. And like I said, I was 15, so I know I'm a part of standing out in history. I'm just not a part of their story. And it's all good because there's other stories that need to be told.
Definitely, man. And in terms of it,
But not to cut your bill, this is a true story real quick, just so
go ahead, have some time.
I haven't watched the series, but maybe you are abreast of it. But inside the first season, there was a song that was represented on tape called No More Mr. Nice Guy. The real No More Mr. Nice Guy was download record of Ghostface Killah and myself, Pop the Brown Hornet. Even if you go grab my solo album, The Underground Emperor, when I was on MCA, mm-hmm. I had a song on that album called No More Mr. Nice Guy. So I'm one of the originators of that song, No More Mr. Nice Guy. But in the Hulu series, they said that song, Ghostface's song, was a rebuttal song that Method Man made about dissing Stapleton. So those are lies. That's not true. And,
gotcha.
No More Mr. Nice Guy was my song, and that song was produced by R&S. So when they say Ghostface went to go see a producer, the producer was R&S. They just don't say our name and give us credit. But yeah, that's the truth. So yeah, like I said, I don't watch it, but I know damn sure, and anybody could tell you that No More Mr. Nice Guy wasn't a Ghostface solo song.
Right, and that's why.
So we do it with Off the Cuff Radio. We put clarity to everything.
Yeah. Exactly. We want artists coming on to be able to tell their story in terms of any inconsistencies or inaccuracies. You know, so they're like King said, can bring clarity and truth. You know, honesty, candor.
One thing I want you to grab from that Hulu story. It's called the American, what is it called, the American Saga?
Wu-Tang, I think the Americans,
I don't think it's called Wu-Tang in American Saga, is it?
Was it American Dream or American Saga?
Yeah, it's like an American Saga,
American
whatever,
Saga.
Whatever. But, yeah, but what I think it really is, it's like, you know, maybe 30% true about the Klan, and then all the stories that are around it may be offspring stories to what really happened, but they're all fabricated. So, and that's just to make their saga, because the whole series is probably a vision of maybe one or two individuals that made it, and they probably, like I said, they didn't want to tell the real stories, so they fabricated some stories, and you know they grabbed the nucleus of the story is the Wu-Tang, so you know it made it simple to be able, but not even those characters. I mean, I think on the first series they had Raekwon sleeping on the roof and on a tent. Who the hell during the crack era? You know what I mean? So it was a couple of stories that I heard that was in there, and you know that didn't even spark my interest to want to even look at it.
Yeah, and that's wild.
Well, you on to get some clarity about that.
Yeah.
Listen. I'm not here to take any away from them and the Wu-Tang fans and but yes, I would definitely love to anybody who's listening, especially in the immediate future, when things pick up, I'm going to definitely need a production crew, somebody out there who wants to know more than just the one-sided story you've been hearing. There's so many different other stories from out of Staten Island. So I plan to stay relevant and, you know, be attached to more artists that's up and coming from out of Staten Island.
Yeah, and Yeah, when you're dealing with stuff like that, man, that's always the bad part sometimes when you're dealing with any show, not just the Woo series, but just any show, because there's always going to be some exaggerations, fabrications. It's not always going to be a real depiction of the actual events. You know, you got to look at the language in terms of inspired by or based on a true story or inspired by a real event, you know, because all those words do make a difference in terms of mm-hmm. how the story is going to be told, you know.
Right.
It's like Casino, you know. It's like with Casino, you know, shout out, of course, to Martin Scorsese. You know, Casino is based on real events that happened, but it's not necessarily the whole true story. It was, you know, it was based off a book that, it, you know, that documented it. Just like with the Godfather series, that was inspired by, you know, when Mario Puzo wrote that book. That movie is inspired by real life, you know, is a fictionalized account of real mafia families put into a story. You know, if you already know the mafia history with certain people, then you know where those stories come together in terms of who they're talking about. But, yeah.
The story is always told by the winner. So
I call his story. Yeah,
that the winner is always telling a story. Mm-hmm. You know he's gonna leave out some small victories from the individual who he defeated.
Right.
You know what I mean? So if you're the winner in the people's eyes, they're gonna have more tendency to believe you than the one who lost.
Definitely. We got a few minutes. We got about 10 minutes left, Pop. One thing about it in terms of the game and still doing it, what is the freedom like in terms of you in this stage of, you know, music and being doing what you do, that you're able to just do projects at your leisure and feel like it and really not having constraints on anything?
I mean, just like with anything, you know, some, you know, just having freedom to work at your pace could probably just bring out the best in you. There's always times where you want to be challenged, and you got to be able to challenge yourself as well. You got to be able to say, you know what, let me try to, you know, write 3 songs in a week. It might not come out that great, but you want to challenge yourself, because one thing that you always want to do is you want to prepare yourself. What if you do make it? You know, you might be hit with a situation where you got to write a song in a day or two. Or you might have to write a song right there on the spot, you know. So you always want to take yourself out of your normal pattern, you know. You always want to be creative and keep those creative juices flowing.
Yeah, man. Who would you like to work with? Which artists are you really into right now that you would like to work with down the line?
I'm not saying I can't say for sure. I mean, I would love maybe to do a couple of tracks with a few of them R&B dudes. I got that would be game for any artist or what have you. But I don't think I have one in particular. I don't think it's just like, yo, that one or this one. But there are. Couple of R&B. I just want to make classic different music, you know, so that's a difficult question, but I would say put me in a studio with Bruno Mars. Let's make a joint.
Bruno, if you're listening, you got a hit on your hands with this guy. Come, y'all need to do this.
Come on, man, we need that. We need that pop money, man.
Yeah, we need. Yeah, but you know what? Let's. You figure like this. My thing is always like when you had Maria.
Project.
So you want to always be creative when you're doing something that's outside the box, and then you want to throw your hip hop to it. But I just believe that you know, when you grab talents that. And you make a mesh, you know, when Old Dirty Bastard did that, Mariah, hey, Mariah, if you look like light, baby's a bass of fire, older dog,
no liar.
Jump, jump. You know what I mean? It just, sometimes you just get that chemistry. So if a beat go on and boom, 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 before you know it, and then you got a hit. Sometimes that's how that works.
And just don't know. You just don't know when that hit record just going to come. It just happens.
And that's why you want to be prepared. That's why you want to write. You want to have your thought pattern. You want to be free artistically. You don't want to be chained down mentally. You just want to be able to fly. So when opportunity shows face, I mean, your fans get to see you at your rawest stage and rawest form. At your, and being free, your creative juices, man. They just, I could sit down and I write some outlandish rhymes like they ain't gonna play that motherfucker. But I'll still, I think this is the time to be edgy. That's why I have a song called Touchy Feely and things of that nature, because I think hip hop should get back to where it was. I remember we used to turn on the radio and you could hear hip hop and all kinds of, like you said, from the Two Live Crew to Akinelli to it was just so many different songs that you would hear, and they weren't all politically correct, but I think that's what made hip hop what it was, to raw different sounds and people being not afraid to be artistic.
And that's one thing about it, man. There's nothing like just being able to kind of dictate your own pace and, really be, let your creative juices flow, in a game like we talked about earlier, where copycat has become common. It's great to see originality, and that's what makes your talent truly outstanding in your expression. We're closing an end to another extraordinary, educational, inspirational, and incredible interview, Pop. We cannot thank you so much for your time, your wisdom. You know, you're welcome back anytime, whatever you got coming. Tell everybody out there listening, where we can find you at out in social media, what you got coming, what you've already done, and what the best is yet to come.
Well, yeah, for all the people listening, my latest work, Forman Mandela, is streaming on all digital platforms, Forman Mandela. I have songs with King Just, No Smoke, streaming, Daydreaming, which you played at the top of the show with the Force MD, streaming everywhere. And I have a new single that I'm pushing out right now called Touchy Feely. It's streaming everywhere as well. Video soon to come. If everything goes well, 2022, I'll be doing a new album, something fresh. I don't want to give out no hints or where it's going to come from, hopefully, as well, on Bombify Enterprises that I have on WhoMag Distribution with Rob Schwartz. I have my own distribution as well, Bombify Enterprises. So hopefully I'll be debuting a couple of up-and-coming artists from my area. So that's what I really want to do. I want to tap into the up-and-coming as well and debut some young MCs, lyrical MCs. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
If you want to get at me on social media, Instagram, you can get at me at Pop the Brown Hornet_grain related. To get at me on Facebook or Twitter, it's Pop the Brown Hornet. Facebook and TikTok, Pop the Brown Hornet, Pop the Brown Hornet. So, yeah, brother, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Definitely was a pleasure talking to you, brothers, talking about the past and things of that nature. Just gets the creative juices flowing even more. So definitely appreciate you, brothers, taking the time out to have me on your platform.
We appreciate you coming on. Thank you so
much.
Thank you.
Yeah, we definitely appreciate you, man. A big shout out to Angela Covington for making this happen. We're going to keep pushing the culture alive.
Definitely that. Definitely a shout out. So yeah, once again, Pop the Brown Hornet signing off.
Bumblefire. Yep. We out.
Peace.